So the world has its dangers, tics. To mention just the closest at hand, and the world has its dangers, and we try to live as wisely as we can with the dangers of the world, and we don't want to live in some kind of romantic fantasy, that pastoral fantasy that the world is just this idyllic place. It has its dangers, but it also happens that one of the dangers that exists in the world is you. that danger you could do something about. The ways in which we are unkind to ourselves, the ways in which we cling and hold on tightly, the ways in which we don't care for ourselves in the places that we've been hurt, or the ways in which we override some of the natural needs that we have, the ways that there's a whole series of things we do that bring on suffering. The Buddhist, slogan that Buddhism gives, to reduce it just to one kind of simple phrase, is that it calls the danger that you provide yourself is the danger of suffering, and how we bring on that danger is by craving or clinging, grasping. So it's a very simplistic, but it's pointing to something very ordinary that I hope, as I've said the other day, I hope all of you have confirmed that in certain circumstances it's true. That if you really, really want something and are attached to wanting it, that there are times when you can really see the suffering that's part of it. And then if you have the ability to let go of that clinging, you can feel the release of that suffering. It's not a complicated thing. At times, it can be very ordinary. And so one of the tasks of Buddhism is to learn how to make our hearts a safe place to live, to make our minds a safe place to live, so that as we go through our life, that at least that place, that source, is not a place of danger for us, not going to cause suffering for ourselves or cause suffering for others. And the hope, I think, is that if our heart is a place that's safe, that then we can, we'll be wiser in how to negotiate the external dangers. And if the external dangers come anyway, that we'll be wiser about how to respond to that. That we'll respond to it without our hearts adding second arrows or third arrows or making it more difficult than it has to be. And on one hand, to me it's been very meaningful to repeatedly go back and look at almost any Buddhist teaching that you hear and assume that you already know it. They're just pointing to something that's very ordinary and that's part of everyday life. Something you probably know already. Just they put it in that darn Buddhist vocabulary. And if they would only, talk in English. we could see how ordinary it is. So on one hand, it's helpful to see that. On the other hand, it's helpful also to appreciate that to take this ordinary, pointing to an ordinary possibility, that to do it thoroughly, to do it fully in our lives, is pretty revolutionary. It's pretty fantastic, pretty awesome thing in this world of ours. And part of the task of practice is to take something very ordinary and let the potential and possibilities within the ordinary blossom to its as full as it can be in our lives, as full as it seems appropriate for us. So the ordinary thing of Nancy serves cookies for tea. I don't know if she did it this retreat or not. But, this, you go back for seconds, and there's one cookie left. And, you really want that cookie, and it tastes so good, the pleasure of it, and you've had a hard day sitting, and certainly you deserve some comfort, and you're a really good eater. So, you haven't been able to show your identity so well at this retreat, so here you have to really kind of show people what a good eater you are. It has a lot of importance, that cookie. And you go back and there's one cookie left, but there's someone else heading towards it too. Panic, fear, anger, jealousy, competition. Of course, very small and subtle, but these things come up. And you see, perhaps, the suffering of that. You see the pain of that, of holding on to that desire for the cookie. And so perhaps, given that, maybe you feel compassion for that person who also wants a cookie. So you release, you let go of that desire, that clinging, and you feel better. At least feel better from the than you felt when you had the competition for the cookie. So that was an attempt to point to something ordinary, right? That's the Four Noble Truths. There was clinging, there was suffering, there was a cause of it, and grasping, and there was a possibility of ending it, releasing it. So, but what do we do with the deeper things of life? What do we do with issues that we think are much more deeply fundamental to our lives, like work and relationships and homes and our identity and, these things that, life and death, sickness. So the idea is to take this ordinary thing and discover how it operates also in the places that seem really big. And in order to do that, I think we need two things. We need to look carefully, be mindful, to really study, to see clearly what's there, and to see without any filters in our eyes, to cultivate a clarity of seeing, and just see clearly what's there. And the other thing I believe is really helpful is love, is to have compassion and love or kindness towards what is here. The whole process. I suspect that it's really difficult, maybe impossible, to release the places, the deepest places of holding we have, if the deepest places of holding we have don't feel our kindness, doesn't feel the compassion or care. Or to say it in a very different way, if the deepest places of holding we have, if they don't feel safe from us, if you're these tender places, deep tender places, if these places don't feel, what they feel from us is our animosity, our hostility, or I'm going to fix you. You shouldn't be there. You're supposed to be different. You have to measure up to some other ideal, but you just don't make the grade. You got to do something about you. And there's so many different attitudes we have that can just make what is deepest inside of us feel like it just wants to cower and hold on tighter. But to be able to turn and see things with kindness, and to see it so it feels safe from you, it's okay to show itself. Then something can transform. So this week we're kind of touching on the theme of awakening as the kind of theme to weave through our talks. And though it's a beautiful concept, the idea of awakening, there's plenty of places in the, if you go back and read the suttas, there are other words that are probably more commonly used by the Buddha for his goal. And one of them is, it's more like words like release or freedom or liberation. And the significance between the difference is that words like awakening, sometimes translated into English as enlightenment, lends itself to a lot of lofty thinking, to a lot of high ideals. And one of the great debates down through the history of Buddhism that continues to the present time is, what is enlightenment? What exactly is it? This thing, this enlightenment, this awakening, is a thing, is a state, is an experience. But if you don't get hung up in this word awakening, but remember that the synonym is release, then it gives a very different emphasis. The emphasis is not on what you attain, but rather what you free yourself from. The emphasis is not on what you experience in terms of some wonderful, perfect state, but what you've been able to shed that has gotten in the way, that's held you in bondage, is the classic language. So we let go of, we release ourselves from that which makes our life, brings suffering to our life. I was sitting here earlier with you this morning, and I felt a strong feeling, just sitting here, that just to sit here was enough. Just to sit here was enough. Nothing needed. It wasn't like I needed. Nothing needed to happen. It felt kind of very beautiful to just sit here and be at peace, be at peace and content. Just nothing needed to happen. Just being sitting here was enough. And maybe that simple statement doesn't seem to measure up to the lofty visions people can have of what enlightenment is and all that. But if you look at how many people live their lives, they usually, there's so many things that get in the way of even that realization, that just to sit here is enough. There's so many forces inside of us that, you know, that this moment is not enough. This is not enough. The grass is greener somewhere else. You know, you so much wanted to come to a Vipassana retreat, to a week here, try, it felt so wonderful. And within 3 or 4 days of being here, you're wondering about Tibetan Buddhism. I wonder, or Zen, you know. This is okay, but I wonder, they might have it there, the real thing. You know, the grass is greener somewhere else. Here we're just trudging it out, you know. Here's just reality, you know, and my, but they over there, they have it. That's where it's not real anymore. That's where it's, you know, they're floating in clouds over there. So this moment is not enough. There's somewhere else it's better, or there's some imminent danger, and I have to always be alert and anxious to protect myself about the dangers here, the dangers elsewhere. Or there can be deep-seated attitudes that there's something really fundamentally, absolutely completely, thoroughly ingrained in the patterns, the laws, the way the universe was constructed. You know, 5 billion years of evolution just has, you know, it's inherent in this whole evolutionary development and growth right up to today that you're inadequate. So that's a good news. So of course sitting here can't be enough, because you're not enough, because it's built into the fabric of our universe. I don't know, where do you get the idea? I mean, there is no manual. You know, I haven't seen the manual that says you are inadequate. Thou shalt be. There's no one who has the authority, the right to say that for anybody. But having these deeply embedded attitudes can keep us from relaxing, just being here. Just sitting here is enough. Or there's deep sorrow, grief that we carry inside, or anger. And it just feels too much to touch it, too much to open to it, and so we recoil. And the idea of just being simple and present and sitting is frightening, because I can't. If I just sit there and let this moment be enough, that means I have to. This stuff will bubble up. I can't do that. Or sure, you know, yeah, Gil, I mean, yeah, just sitting here is enough. I know that really well, but it's not that, you know, it's not that beautiful paradise of full-blown diamond samadhi. I mean, that's where it's really at, right? Only when I have this wonderful, full-blown, big bang enlightenment. I'm more like the... You know, I'm in the Green Beret school of Buddhism, you know. A few good men. You know, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to leave all these, just sitting here is enough, people, back in the dust. You know, it's important for me to, I'll show what's really possible here, and be the Buddhist superstar. I don't know. You can fill in the blanks better than I can, I'm sure, of all the attitudes and things we have that get in the way. And to free ourselves up from all that keeps us from just being here in a full way, in a simple way, pointing back to something ordinary again. Just here, being here, ordinary, simple. Here we are. But it can take years of deep, committed, courageous work to work through so many things, release so many things, so we come to the point where just sitting here and being ordinary. So the Buddhist teachers who have been most meaningful for me have been the ones who seem the most ordinary. I didn't get any sense of something special. It's just there's there. So this goes along with what seems to be a big reluctance on the part of the Buddha to not really define what awakening is in positive terms, but rather to describe it by what's absent. What's not there? What's released? What's been liberated? What we're liberated from? And part of the wisdom of this is that maybe a life, when someone's been liberated, or different people are liberated, the way that their life is experienced after liberation is individual to them. they find their own unique way of living that way. There isn't like one way to be enlightened or be liberated or spiritually mature. The analogy I like is that if two people are released from prison at the same time, we can say that, you know, the experience of release is the same. To be in the same prison, same experience, same food, same everything, and then the gates open for them and they both walk out. So that experience of being released is the same. In order to be released, the gates have to open for both in the same way. But what their experience after they're out of prison will probably diverge, and they'll have very different experiences of how they live their lives and what their experience is, depending where they go and the world they walk into. So the experience of what we're released from is the same. And so we can point to that. But we can't necessarily say what that person's supposed to be like after that, what their experiences are going to be like, both in terms of, you know, the states of mind or how they live their life in some ways. What the tradition does say, though, is that what they'll have in common after being released is that they're going to live an ethical life. That comes with freedom, because to live unethically generally means that we're still caught by something. And as we're released from, then the forces to be unethical tend not to be there. So there's in the tradition then a number of lists and descriptions of what people are released from. And today I'd like to talk about three things. And as people mature in this practice, there are at some point they get released from what's called, or what can be called, the attachment to their personality, or their attachment to defining their personhood, their being, by any particular way. Could usually call personality view, the opinions we have about who I really am, the way we're attached to self-identity. The second is that as people have a real immediate and clear sense of what the experience of release is like, then they're not confused about what the practice is and isn't. And they don't have any more doubt. So the third is that because they know what the practice is all about, what release is about, they don't, they no longer mistake other practices for release. So to give an example or analogy, you know that when someone is maybe angry, they can maybe make a fist with their hand. It's, you know, all the energy and contraction of anger, they make a fist. And some people, you know, can be chronically angry. So imagine some person has been angry for a few decades and they have a hard time opening their fist because they're really attached to their anger. So it hurts. They want to do something about it. So they start taking vitamins. Or they wear a crystal around their neck. The crystal certainly will help. You know, or I'll, you know, go around and burn thyme all over my apartment. Certainly that will help. And, you know, there's, or, you know, I'll read astrology, or, you know, there's a lot of things you can kind of get, you know, a lot of, the world has no shortage of promising things. You can spend a lifetime chasing after all the promises. That's going to do it, that's going to do it. But someday, at some point, maybe someone tickles you or something, and you, or I don't know what it takes, but you relax your hand, and you open your hand and say, oh, that's what it takes. I have to let go. And you see the letting go, opening of the hand. Oh, that's how I released myself from the suffering of that tight fist. I used to have to open up. And then you realize it wasn't really an issue of vitamins. It was just a matter of doing this releasing. So it's normal and probably to be commended that people are looking for some way to be happy, some way to be free of their suffering they have. But it's not easy to know what is effective and helpful for that process. And so people look in all kinds of places and ways that are not so helpful. After my first kind of really clear moment of release that I had on a retreat, it was a beautiful moment. And the whole world stopped. It was just a dramatic moment of everything stopping. And there was kind of clear feeling in that moment of there being, in that experience, in that moment, no self in a way I'd never experienced before. Well, I'll tell you how it happened was that I'd been sitting retreat at Sashin at Green Gulch. And in the afternoon they served tea. So I'd been sitting kind of intently, trying to be intent. I wasn't very concentrated, but I was trying to be concentrated. But then they served tea in the meditation hall. So I, without thinking about it, I kind of stopped trying so hard. I released myself from all this trying. And I picked up the cup of tea, and as I took a sip from the cup, and felt the water kind of, for the tea water kind of go across my lip and my tongue, everything stopped. And there was, the only way to describe it, I mean, it's not rational or something, but logical, but everything stopped. And there was no self there. But there was these little words in my mind that wasn't me saying it, that was part of the not self aspect of it. There was just this things being said that I wasn't saying it. Just, and the word said, I stop the sip. That's all. And I was so amazed by this whole experience. But the fact that there were words connected to it, I was like, wow, words. That's amazing. Words. So I went and got a subscription to a magazine called General Semantics. Vitamins. You know, I didn't know how to understand my experience, what had happened. So somehow I got hooked by the word aspect of it. I got fascinated by language and how would they come from and words, and went down kind of this detour. So to begin appreciating the movement of release, of letting go, of not tight, holding tight or not resisting, and to see directly for yourself how that's beneficial, is part of how the wisdom of Buddhism, the maturation in the Buddhist tradition, begins to occur. And that helps if you start appreciating even the small ways, which you're already doing it. Because you are doing it in small ways. You wouldn't get this far. You wouldn't get to be an adult unless you succeeded in doing some of this letting go. So appreciating how you already do it, and then begin to take the lessons of that and realize that what a profound thing it is to open the fist of our hand, the fists in our heart. And so one of the first real experiences or levels of maturation in this tradition comes when we really have complete confidence in the value, the power, the significance of this movement of release. How this release of the heart, of the mind, is the way that we can make ourselves safe. The way that we can make ourselves not have second arrows or third arrows that we add to our experience. How we become our own, find, this is how we can really find, be at home in our own hearts. So, one of the places that people cling to a lot is they cling to their self-concept. It's not easy to live a human life. And the task of any human life is to find out how to survive, how to have livelihood and get along with other people. And it's complicated, this world. People are complicated. Relationships are complicated. Finding our way is complicated. And so, to some degree, it's a lot of, some things are up to you. And some things are not up to you. And how to figure that out, and how to find yourself in relationship to other people, understand who you are in relationship to other people, is a very complicated task. And so, one of the things that comes along with that is developing of ideas and concepts of who we are and what we need and who other people are and what needs to happen. And we develop a whole series and slew of ideas. Some of them we develop on our own, and some of them are helped by others, and some of them from our society that we kind of take in unconsciously, just what our society believes. And there's, if I look back at my childhood and remember, there were moments in my childhood where there was something happened, and because of that thing, I then defined myself. This is who I am. I am this kind of person. One of the really clear moments was in seventh grade. I was taking art class, and I didn't really care. I wasn't thinking about art. I had to do art in the class. That was the assignment. And the art teacher came over to me, looked at what I was drawing, and said to me, without any charge, without, you know, just matter-of-factly, "Gil, you have no artistic ability." So, I didn't care. It didn't matter to me. I wasn't concerned about being an artist, or it had no value, no meaning to me particularly, except that this was the authority. So, of course, it must be true. So for the next 6 years, I carried with me this thought that I had been injected with. I have no artistic ability. And in fact, it turns out I had some. But it wasn't until I was in college that that was revealed to me. Because I carried with me this idea. I didn't suffer because of this idea. I just didn't, this is the way the universe was built. So a whole series of things, all of you can go back and look at particular things that happened in life, and maybe how your friends related to you, or what they said to you, or experiences in school or family, this means that I'm this kind of person. Or maybe it's coping mechanisms that, in order to survive in your growing up, you had to assume a certain role in your family, and so that role became who you thought you were. And then our society kind of asks us to be certain ways. And it's really hard for us, unless you kind of really have a clear experience of living in different cultures, it's really hard to see how each culture, your own culture, has its own cultural views about what it means to be a person in relationship to others. And otherwise, we will take our way, our cultural way, as the fabric of the universe. This is how it is, and not a culturally conditioned phenomena. I saw it with my... when I had my first son was, about two or three. it became clear in a way that I hadn't seen knew before what a strong emphasis I have had on raising him as an individual, independent individual. That's how I was raised. In the Norwegian culture that I grew up in, you know, come out of, you know, there's a long, long history of very strong individualism. A different flavor than American individualism, but still it's there. And that's what's, you know, validated and encouraged. And I saw the way I talked to my son, it was encouraging. I said, "Oh, look at that, Gil. You're doing it. You're actually." So I felt lucky that I could see it. Then see, this is a cultural condition. This is a choice. This is a particular approach. I spent time living in Asia, and it was really clear to me how very different they have a view. And it isn't that the individualistic view is necessarily bad or wrong. Or the more collectivist view of Japan, for example, is better or worse or something. Every culture has to have a view in order to kind of, so we don't bump into each other too much. But then if we get locked into it and think this is the way it really is, that assumption, holding on, lends itself to clinging and holding and keeps us from being free. And part of the function of deep meditation practice is to be able to get quiet enough to see how the subtle movements of self-definition, subtle movements of clinging and ideas, subtle movements in which we have these ideas about what we need and who we are and what's going on, are operating. And then to begin questioning them, or to realize that they're just ideas that maybe have their time and place, and so at certain times we can act on them. We don't have to necessarily see ourselves as that's this is who I really am. And so to be able to get mindful enough to begin seeing how the ideas of self arise, how we construct the ideas of self around something. We come into the kitchen and you see that you're identified with being the best eater at Hidden Villa, you know, or eating out there in the porch. I mean, I don't know how it is for you. Probably all of you are much more relaxed and free than I was. Many of my retreats were sitting down to eat at the meal. You know, all these other people around, all these other Buddhas around. These, you know, people who practiced for a long time and. You know, have I stuck my fork into the broccoli the right way? You know, I don't. You know, did I bring it up to my? Am I eating too fast? You know, I mean, heaven forbid that you be a fast eater at a Vipassana retreat. I mean, then you know, that's the wrong kind of identity to have, the wrong person to be, and it's very important to be seen. You know, as the right kind of person, and so you look around, how do you eat in a Vipassana retreat so I can do it right? So everybody's, and so how would you eat slow? You know, so, you know, this thing about eating mindfully, who knew? I didn't know anything about that when I was a new student, but eating slow, you know, that was the way of being a good student. Thank you. Or, you know, or to be a good sitter. You know, I'm the one who's not going to move. I'm the non-moving one in here. You know, I'm not going to show everybody else how you don't move when you sit. Yeah. Or I'm the wiggly one. You know, boy, I'm a disaster for Buddhism. I'm sure these Buddhists think, you know, what bus did I get off? You know, the way I wiggle all the time. I'm the wiggler. You know, so then we have this attachment, I'm the wiggler. As opposed to, you know, just, oh, I'm wiggling, there's wiggling going on, you know, but you don't have to make identity. Identity, especially, you can see it operating clearly when you're concerned other people are seeing you that way. You're wondering how the other people are looking at you. And so there's a whole series, it goes on and on and on, the self-game, the self-constructed ideas that we live under and live with. And some of them are traps, like this being an individual. You know, it's easy, I think, many people to see now that it's a lot of suffering in being individual too much, and to be unique, to be autonomous, because you can't really be autonomous. You know, they say that the Americans have this very intense individualistic kind of autonomy emphasis. In the culture that's probably more interdependent than any culture in the world's ever been. You know, it's just, you know, we, none of us can do almost anything for ourselves. I mean, and some of you probably even forgotten how to cook. You just use the microwave. But, you know, you go to other, some lot places in the world now, and they're still self-sufficient farmers. They can do everything for themselves. They don't need to go to the store. We're individualists in a society that we're completely dependent on others. And so, and then we have cultures that are kind of collectivist cultures, but that also has its suffering, because then some people, you get too tight to like, then you can't breathe, you can't feel like you can step out of that or express yourself into who you are. I've known people who've left their collectivist culture, come to America, and after being in America for 6 months, it's almost impossible to go back, because it's, you know, it feels too confining. So what are the options? There's suffering in being an individualistic culture, there's suffering in being in a collectivist culture, there's probably suffering in being in one that's right in the middle between the two. What do? You pendulum swings, too much individualistic, so you go to the collective, too much collective, you go to individual. Where's the solution? The solution is to release, to let go. To learn how to let go of the concepts, the attachments we have around these ideas of self and others and all these things. Not to abandon them, but so that we can pick them up wisely, pick up those which are useful in the right time and place. I think that to play the self game, you're always going to be caught in a world of tension, the tension between being individual and being part of a collective or a group. And you can't win that tension if you play the game. But it's possible to let go of the game. And so as we sit on retreat, it's one of the places to begin noticing how we get caught in self, how we get attached to self concepts and ideas. And again, don't underestimate the value of seeing it in the small things here on the retreat. I suffered a lot in years of Buddhist practice because I thought practice was only about what happened on the cushion. And so I didn't pay attention to what happened anywhere else. And so I just would suffer merrily along outside of the cushion. I could get sometimes pretty suffering free on the cushion. But then, you know, what in the dining room? What does eating have to do with the great world religion of Buddhism, and paying attention to how I eat and what I think about other people as I'm eating? I mean, that's not where it's at. I would eat so I can go back to sit. What I'm trying to say is that if you, the small places in your ordinary life, it's as important as anywhere else. That's where the lessons are. That's where we can discover. And this is not complicated spiritual engineering, the teachings of not self. This is to see in the small, you know, in small and big ways in our life, the ways in which we get caught and identified in certain ways. I am this kind of person. I'm the victim. I'm the one who's been hurt. I'm the one who has needs. My needs have to be met. All kinds of things. And to learn to kind of loosen, soften, let go. So a lot of this can be translated to the expression not taking things personally. Not taking anything personally. It doesn't mean that we don't take responsibility for ourselves and what we do and our responses and reactions. But not take it personally means we don't latch onto it with... we don't cling to it. We don't get dragged down by it. We don't get limited by it. If you remember the analogy from the first night of what it feels like to be awake from a refreshing nap, chances are there's very little selfing going on in that those moments. It's a simple experience of being alive without being caught up in the selfing game. You don't have to wait for some big bang experience. You can see it in the ordinary things of life. And to begin appreciating, you don't have to take things personally. Thoughts arise. One of the great pieces of advice my father gave me when I was 14, it's kind of father-son talk, he said to me, if, as you grow up, from time to time, you're going to have some really bizarre thoughts. He said, don't worry about it. Everyone has that from time to time. So, okay, I thought, fine. But then, sooner or later, at some point, I had bizarre thoughts. And I had been warned. I said, oh, it's one of those. That's what happens to people. My father warned me. So I didn't take it so personally. I didn't make it a big story or get worried or, oh, just, you know, it passed. I thought it was a great favor my father did, that little thing. To have thoughts bubble up and not take them so personally. Reactions, feelings, even our sufferings, even our clinging. There can be a lot of clinging about clinging. A lot of selfing, a lot of self-identity around the fact that I'm clinging so much, I'm suffering. But not take your suffering even personally. There's this kind of freedom that can come when we allow things to be without this kind of hanging ourselves from it. So this thing about taking things personally, one of the things that people can take personally is their level of spiritual maturity, how enlightened they are. Or, you know, when I get enlightened, then I can't wait. Then I'll be the special person, and it'll be great. But when you think about it being release and liberation, one thing, a point of view that's helped me is I don't get liberated. Rather, I'm liberating all things. I'm releasing everything so things are free of my clinging. So rather than framing it as, oh, I'm doing something for me and I'll be this special person, nothing to do with you at all. It's rather your generosity and care and love that you're freeing everything from you. From your clinging to it or judging it or condemning it or all the ways in which we kind of add suffering to the world. So how do you free yourself? Free your suffering from yourself, free your sorrow or your grief, so that it can come. Not taken personally, it's safe, it's okay for who you are to come forth. And as it's safe for everything you are to come forth, and you don't interfere with it, then you're in a much better position to understand how to be wise with it, how to live and act in the world in wise ways. So to begin having an appreciation of release, the value, the importance of it, and then to understand that how central release is to the practice, so that we don't confuse other things for release. We don't think that, you know, so it's not just a matter of vitamins, but even the Buddhism says that even living an ethical life, as important as it is in Buddhism, living an ethical life, that itself is not release. And so we don't want to confuse an ethical life with release, which some people do. They think if I become ethically pure, then I'll be free. No, freedom is, release is found in release, letting go. And then to know that well enough that you don't confuse other things for release, for what's really required. And you have no doubts about the value of release, or that release is where the path is found, the heart of the path. To have no doubt about that, even though it might be difficult, it's not easy to do this, but you have no doubt about it. That is considered one of the important steps of maturation in this tradition of Theravada Buddhism. And then together with that comes, and really to have this kind of confidence and faith, no doubt, it really helps to begin appreciating, really understanding some deep visceral way that we don't have to cling to anything as being the self. We don't have to hold to any particular definition. This is who I am. We don't have to, and the word here is we don't have to hold to any definition. You can use definitions, but you don't have to hold or cling to find this is absolutely who I am. The smell of a rose is not captured in the word rose. Who you are in your fullness is not captured by any definition that you hold to for who you are. Just as the smell of a rose wafts out freely, lightly, and doesn't damage anything that it touches, so may your free heart open and be expand outwards and float outwards into the world such that you do not damage anything, that you're safe. Safe to yourself and safe to others. May you let go into being awake.